We're going into our third and last panel before we go into general public comment. So we're very pleased to welcome Shelley Bowen, the president of the Barr Syndrome Foundation, Josephine Grima, the vice president of research and legislative affairs for the National Marfan Foundation, and Amy Kirk, coordinator of family services for the Batten Disease Support and Research Association. Do you have a preference as to who goes first? Or? Pointing at me.
First.
All right.
I'll go first.
Okay, first.
Shelley, you're up.
Since I got lucky and got the hot seat. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting us to come here, and it's an honor to be able to speak on behalf of the children who have Barr syndrome. Barr syndrome is an X-linked disorder. It was until the mid-1990s it was considered uniformly fatal in infants. My experience with Barr syndrome was as a mother. I was a de novo carrier, just as Pat Furlong was, of two boys who had the disorder. One of my sons died in 1990 from Barr syndrome, and I now have will be 21 on Friday, who has Barth. So he is a new survivor, but with that comes new and unique challenges. We have had some experience personally with some challenges with Social Security, with getting Michael listed as being disabled, and I went into that some into the testimony and my written testimony, and at this point I'm kind of sad that I was so wordy in this whole description. But I just would like to describe a bit about the disorder. It's a severe inherited error in metabolism. It causes a remodeling of the cardiolipin, which affects the mitochondrial organelle of every cell of the body. It causes cardiomyopathy, rebounds. You can have rebounds of heart failure, where children can go in and out of heart failure, fatal arrhythmias, skeletal myopathy, delayed growth. You'll see osteopenia and osteoporosis. And one of the aspects of the disorder that really isn't fully understood is fatigue and weakness that these boys experience, sometimes being so dramatic that it's debilitating. These rebounding issues with heart failure, you will see arrhythmias appear usually in the years of puberty, and the children, the oldest children that we're aware of in the United States are into the second decade of life, about 25 years of age. So these parents, about 70 boys are in the United States. These parents have been very high functioning families. They are just now beginning to see these issues where these children are growing up and getting out of school from high school and then going into college. Most of them have been homeschooled. The parents have had to adapt. These children don't have a skeletal muscular dystrophy. They've never had muscles. They never had muscle tone. So it may look like a beefy little child that's fat and looks very healthy. But the cruelest part about this disorder is that these children do appear deceptively healthy. My greatest challenge with my son, and I think I need to speak to this because Michael is one of the oldest survivors, is that we had a challenge. It took us nearly a year to get through the process with Social Security to get Michael listed as being disabled. It took a lot for me to check that box off to say that my kid that I've trained and taught to be an asset to society, taught him to be able, and then have to check it off. That was hard. But realizing that he was no longer going to be qualified as a dependent on my husband's insurance, I knew that I had to do something. So I spent the night before my son went into the hospital and he was in heart failure, I spent the evening going over the paperwork and finally submitted it all, including papers that describe the disorder, the gene discovery, all of the journal articles that Michael had actually been in, with circles and tabulations of everything that would actually give the proof and the evidence that we would need for him to be considered disabled. I was shocked when I received the paperwork back 9 months later that said that while it's apparent that you do have a disability, you state that you are disabled. However, judging by your age and your education, he was a straight-A student. Granted, he didn't graduate until he was 20. you should be able to work. He couldn't. He can't. He can only go to school 4 hours a week. And that's Barr syndrome. He's bright, but he wants to do something. And unfortunately, now today, my son with Barr syndrome is uninsured. We have no coverage for him, and he's at risk. So that's my experience. And unfortunately, I feel that there's a lot of people who are going to be behind me that are going to experience the same issues because the adjudicators are not familiar with the disease. Even the medical society, really, or the medical profession isn't that familiar with it because it is a complex multi-system disorder that affects every single cell of the body. It can be debilitating from very early on, and it can start, and you can also see it slowly progress over the child's into the second decade of life. So I would recommend if someone could help high-functioning families and help teach us how to advocate for our families and give you what you need. We do have a biochemical marker that has been developed. It's right now it's in research to distinguish if there is a cardiolipin remodel or a cardiolipin deficiency. This is distinct from the genetic mutation or looking at the TEPHASIN gene. So as was mentioned earlier today, not all of the children are going to be as severely affected as some, but the cardiolipin deficiency would prove you the evidence that you need.
Good. I've got a whole bunch of questions, but I think we're going to stick to what we've been doing. We'll hear from everyone, and then that will give you all a chance to chime in together when we have questions that overlap in areas of interest. So thank you. Josephine?
My name is Josephine Grima, and I'm the Vice President of Research and Legislative Affairs of the National Marfan Foundation, and I'm honored to appear here before you today. I'd like to send a special thank you to Diane Dorman, even though she's not here, for her support and our attention to our concerns. And even though he doesn't want to hear it, I want to send a thank you to Dr. Stephen Groth, who has been a valued friend of the National Marfan Foundation for many years. And lastly, I'd like to thank the Social Security Administration for their leadership over the past year for producing an informational video on Marfan syndrome for their adjudicators so they can help better understand the syndrome. Marfan syndrome is a rare medical condition affecting 40,000 people in the United States. It manifests itself in several body systems, including the cardiovascular, ocular, musculoskeletal, pulmonary, and nervous systems, and to a lesser extent, the skin. Marfan syndrome is a progressive disorder with virtually no prophylactic therapies to modulate the deterioration of the lungs, the joints, the eyes, and the blood vessels. The good news is that the life expectancy of Marfan patients has increased from 45 years of age to 70 years of age, primarily due to elective surgical repair of the aortic root. However, the aging Marfan population is a new entity, and the natural history of this older generation is showing complex disability issues resulting from multiple aortic surgeries, degeneration of the bones and joints, visual problems associated with the dislocation of lenses, dural ectasia resulting in back pain, headaches, and difficult moving their lower extremities, pulmonary problems, hernias, and early onset of arthritis. This is evident to us with the dramatic increase in inquiries to our office during the past 10 years. The chronic debilitating effects of this syndrome have become the leading factors of disability. Individuals are unable to sit or stand for long periods of time to perform basic sedentary work activities. In addition, jobs with more physical requirements are not advised for people with Marfan syndrome because any strenuous activity can cause a dissection of the aorta or aggravate an existing aneurysm or dissection. Even in closely monitored patients, instability of the aorta remains problematic, and it is a fact of Marfan syndrome probably underappreciated by many doctors who do not see many Marfan patients. Marfan syndrome is a life-threatening disorder due to the potential for dissection of the aorta. Currently, Marfan syndrome is listed by SSA as a cardiovascular impairment specific to patients with dissections that are not controlled by prescribed treatment. However, these uncontrolled dissections are the most severe of circumstances, which unfortunately leads to loss of life in many instances. Most dissections, although severe and disabling, can be controlled with medical therapies. The fact that cardiovascular disability determination is based on whether the dissection was uncontrolled misses the mark as the true indicator of disability, in our opinion. In response to the questions posed to us, the processing of claims for patients with Marfan syndrome who meet the disability criteria take a long time to be processed. Most people are denied on the first application and must appeal the initial decision, often multiple times. For those denied multiple times, we believe this is due to the severity of the standards listed in the cardiovascular impairments. Marfan syndrome is a rare disease and it is not well known. The effect of the syndrome on the whole person and not just the cardiovascular system is not understood by the adjudicators or reflected in the listings. Many appeals go all the way to the final judicial review. In many cases, Marfan patients have to be evaluated for effects in multiple body systems. They may not meet the severity requirements of any one of the body systems in other listings, but when multiple, less severe impairments occur, a disabled state can also occur as a result of cumulative effects across the body systems. Adjudicators, and in some cases physicians, are unfamiliar with the multiple system effect of Marfan syndrome and the effect it has on the day-to-day functional abilities of many people. Another major problem is that physicians are unfamiliar with the Social Security application process and do not include the important facts in the letters of support for patients. In addition, published medical evidence for many of the functional limitations is lacking. Therefore, physician requests for disability should be evaluated by adjudicators, and physician reports may need to be weighted more heavily in the evaluation process if an appropriate decision is to be made. Finally, a lot of the SSA staff are unfamiliar with rare diseases and don't take the time with the patients to listen to and learn in order to better understand their functional disability. Marfan syndrome cannot be expedited under terminal illnesses because it is not considered terminal. However, we were very aware of cases where people have had problematic descending aortic dissections, were denied disability, struggled to continue working, and died before ever receiving disability. Unfortunately, it is the lack of appreciation of the instability of the Marfan aorta that appears to create this devastating result. The Supplemental Security Income Program is definitely a good program for those that do not qualify for disability, but again, it has to have more information on rare disorders. In order to improve the current system, our recommendations are as follows. A listing of rare disorders and their disabling symptoms and the impact of each body system for the adjudicators to use would be extremely helpful. Multi-system disorders such as Marfan syndrome should be recognized as such so that the impact of multiple disabilities can be better recognized and evaluated. Guidelines to evaluate multiple factors which do not have concrete medical evidence such as fatigue need to be developed. Guidelines for doctors that explain the types of information and medical records needed to document disability and helpful content for letters would also be useful. Adjudicators also should have a better understanding of how difficult it may be for an individual with a rare disorder to obtain documents to support their application, and therefore they should be more willing to assist patients with the application and obtaining those supporting documents. When people are denied disability, many of them give up and do not understand the role of the appeal. This needs to be clearly stated in plain language in a prominent place. The reasons for the denial need to be specific and clear. and if the application lacks important information, this needs to be stated. The denial letter should explain what additional information might make a different decision. In many cases, we see people applying for disability who have no income. They lack medical insurance to receive medical care, which would address their medical needs and document their disability. So when applying for disability, many need to see SSA doctors for information to help substantiate their claim, but many of the doctors do not know Marfan syndrome. Having physicians that know about rare diseases would be a benefit. Thank you again for this opportunity.
Thank you. Amy?
My name is Amy Kirk. I am the coordinator of family services for the Batten Disease Support and Research Association. And what I do is I try to help families get things like Social Security, Medicaid, to help them out in the school. So I work one-on-one with families to help them go through a lot of this process. Batten disease is the common name for a group of diseases known as neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis and is one of the more common of the neurodegenerative diseases. It is also one of the diseases found in a group known as lysosomal storage disorders. It is a recessive inherited disease, meaning that both parents must carry the defective gene. Batten disease is rarely diagnosed immediately and is often mistaken for epilepsy, mental retardation, retinitis pigmentosa, ADHD, and even schizophrenia in adults. Onset is characterized by beginning vision loss, seizures, clumsiness, personality, and behavior changes. Batten disease causes continual physical and mental deterioration, leading to death. Depending on the form of the disease, children may die as young as 2 or 3, or may live into their 20s or 30s. At this time, there is neither a treatment nor a cure. And many of our families have had to individually list out the conditions of their child's disease when applying for Social Security benefits. We found that it's easier to have them list out every single condition of Batten disease that their child is experiencing rather than putting Batten disease or neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis on their application. When the average person, even the average medical professional, hears the term Batten disease, they have no idea what this entails. To ensure that a family does not experience a prolonged delay in Social Security's decisions, we tell our families to explain the symptoms of the disease as a means of diagnosis. When an SSA adjudicator reads seizure disorder, blindness, fine motor skill impairment, gross motor skill impairment, mobility disorder, et cetera, a quick decision from SSA is much more likely. However, when the term Batten disease is listed, there is always an explanation that needs to come along with it. And for both the sake of our families and the Social Security Administration, we have recommended the individual symptom listing as a way to describe a diagnosis. This in itself, we've found, poses two problems. One, it's not a true diagnosis. Yes, a child has a mobility disorder, but the mobility disorder is a condition of Batten disease. And while we're not lying on the application, we're not really presenting the entire picture either. The second problem is that providing medical information for each of these individual symptoms can be tedious to all involved. Providing the Social Security Administration with a diagnosis of Batten disease would make the process much easier and faster. Instead of searching for ophthalmology records, physical therapy records, neurology records, special education records, and the list keeps going, to prove the diagnosis and pertaining conditions, a diagnosis of Batten diseases in any of the acceptable standards would prove to be much more simpler for our families. In general, we feel that claims are made in an appropriate time frame due to the fact that we have taught the parents how to better get around the application and have a more expedited process. But if these accommodations were not made and our families were kind of going into this blindly, the process would be much slower and much more tedious for families, for medical professionals, and the Social Security Administration. And we feel like most of the general public and general medical profession is unfamiliar with rare diseases, as you've heard, I'm sure, a lot today. Even in terms of specialists, like neurologists, the rare diseases are hardly ever heard about and much less seen. With over 7,000 rare diseases, according to the National Organization for Rare Disorders, it is unlikely that medical professionals may not be as up to speed on the specifics of a disease like Batten disease. Batten disease affects 2 to 4 out of every 100,000 births, so we are very rare. We have about 400 cases right now in the United States. Currently, we have, 400 children in the United States, and most doctors, including neurologists, have seen very few, if any, cases in their entire career. So if it's hard for a doctor to provide knowledge and information on Batten disease, imagine the reaction of a Social Security Administration worker or adjudicator trying to determine eligibility. While most parents have learned to be the medical expert for their child's rare disease, it would be helpful for large government organizations like the Social Security Administration to also be somewhat knowledgeable about the rare disease, even if it just means having it listed in a book. Providing medical records is often not a problem, but providing a large amount of information about the disease may be harder for some doctors to do. The most common problem we have is obtaining an exact diagnosis for Batten disease. Being that Batten disease is an inherited genetic disorder, pinpointing the exact form and location of the gene responsible for the disease is costly and time-consuming. While all the other facts seem to be present, the confirmed DNA diagnosis can hang up the process in many areas, including Social Security benefits. While collecting the medical information may not be hard, it is time-consuming, as I've stated. For children with Batten disease, medical information can come from many professionals in many different fields. Our children may have records from ophthalmologists, neurologists, physical, occupational, and speech therapists, psychologists, classroom aides, laboratories, hospitals, and the list goes on. For children with rare and complicated neurological diseases, the team of specialists can also be very large. And having to collect all this information is important, though, to determine the appropriateness of the SSI and SSDI eligibility and to give non-experts a better overall picture of what the disease entails. One of the most common errors, as many and all of you may know, is the decision time frame. Most families are told that their decision may take weeks or months. Most workers, when asked why it takes so long, and this is a response we get from many of our families, is that the worker says, "We are overloaded right now." While the Social Security Administration is trying to determine the laundry list of symptoms and conditions that a child with Batten disease has, it would be so much easier and faster to be able to look up the rare disease in a manual as a means of determination. As far as the TERI programs and other programs going on right now to help expedite processes within Social Security, I feel personally, and my organization feels, that it isn't a working program because it isn't really being well advertised. I came into this job, I'm still very new at this, but I came in June and knew nothing of the TERI process. And had I known, I would have been telling my families of this all along as a way to get their Social Security applications expedited much quicker, because Batten disease is a terminal illness. It's the perfect type of program for people with rare diseases that are terminal. However, it takes education and outreach on the part of the Social Security Administration to let rare disease organizations know about special clauses like these. I surf all over the Social Security Administration website multiple times, and I have yet to see the TERI program, so I don't know if I'm just not looking in the right place, but it definitely is something that could be more just out there and more advertised for those of us in the profession that are trying to help families with this sort of thing. Parents of children with rare diseases are too wrapped up in the present time with what is happening to their child right now, so what symptoms they do display right now that they thought of their child's life end is not the forefront of their mind. It may also be interesting to know whether Social Security Administration workers and adjudicators are offering up these types of programs to parents with a child who has a rare disease. As stated earlier, we encourage our parents to write every symptom and condition of Batten disease, but while the symptoms are numerous, they do not always point to a terminal illness. So while parents or Social Security Administration workers may not think to ask about special expedited programs for terminal illnesses, while the program itself may work, the widespread education and advocacy about the purpose and the use of the program, I feel, is lacking. Up until now, the Social Security Administration has not done too much to respond to and connect with the rare disease community. I know Mr. Astrew came and spoke at the National Organization for Rare Disease Conference, and that was extremely helpful for me, somebody being new in the profession, but I think it was also very helpful for those of us in the rare disease community. And I think we definitely felt like there was a huge outreach from the Social Security Administration, and I want to thank you for that. It seems very helpful, and it really gives us a lot of encouragement from those of us in the rare disease community. Even though rare diseases seem like a small percentage of the country's population, there are actually 25 million people that have a rare disease, not to mention the families that are also affected. With this new attention being given to the rare disease community, I'd like to encourage you to take it one step farther and begin providing the outreach and education about special Social Security Administration programs that would assist families and individuals experiencing a rare disease. Some of the suggestions I have, and I have a long list here, I was really brainstorming for you. A list of rare disorders and the basic criteria of the disease would be very helpful for adjudicators. Also, having a contact listed next to the disease, like, for example, Batten disease and the Batten Disease Support and Research Association with our 800 number, could help to answer any further questions an adjudicator may have without specifically talking with anyone or about anyone child or family. Batten disease is a rare disease that has many different forms, and each form can bring about symptoms at different stages and rates. This type of information is also important when determining eligibility and thus strengthening the argument for having a contact person on the list. Although a list of rare diseases would be helpful, there are certain things to consider when compiling a list. In regards to Batten disease, the term Batten disease refers to the umbrella heading given to all NCLs, or neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis. There are currently 10 NCLs that we know about, and while all are referred to as Batten disease, each has its own distinctive name as well. Batten disease is not the only rare disease that would fall under this category. That is why it is important for a compiled manual to also list disease aliases. Imagine the upset and frustration for both a family and an SSA adjudicator if a disease listed on the form was not the same wording as listed in the manual, yet it was the exact same disease. And within the manual, it's also important to list all the accepted means of diagnosis for the disease. Consulting with a rare disease organization or a rare disease's top researchers will provide you with all the accepted means of diagnosis. In the case of many rare diseases, gene location for the disease has not yet been determined, and there are other ways of diagnosing a disease without DNA confirmation. Finally, I think I'd just like to share these last few with you. I think a special financial statute should be determined for families with children with rare diseases. Because of the complications associated with the disease and the likelihood of spending more on insurance, medications, medical equipment, and specialists, a family with a child with a rare disease experiences a different level of financial hardship. A family with a child with a rare disease has to make more money just to keep up with the ever-growing pile of bills. A family may have to travel over 100 miles just to see a doctor who actually knows something about their disease. We have many families where that's the case. In the case of Batten disease, as in the case with most rare diseases, there is no treatment. We can only treat the symptoms as a way of treating the disease. A child who has a multitude of different symptoms requires a multitude of medications that can be costly. The drugs that these children are on do not qualify under the new $4 prescriptions that so many pharmacies are now allowing. Medications can range upward of $300 for a month's supply, and that's only one medication. It's also important to realize that parents of children with rare diseases, it's very hard for them to work outside of the home, for both parents to work outside of the home. Many parents choose to stay home and take care of their child, and while they are scrimping and saving every last penny, the Social Security Administration still determines that they make too much money. The SSA needs to take a more realistic look at the true finances of a family who have a child with a rare disease like Batten disease. One of the biggest frustrations that our family experience is the classic line, "You make too much money," which is the truth. And the SSA ends the communication. If the SSA cannot help a family, the workers need to be trained on what other avenues families can turn to for help. It seems like so many of our families just get the door shut right on their face as soon as they're told they make too much money and they're not given any place else to go. Finally, another suggestion would be to improve the information and communication provided by the SSA for rare diseases. In this day and age, people are using the internet for information more and more. It would be beneficial for both the SSA and the rare disease community if a spot on the website was made available specific to benefits for people with rare diseases. The Social Security Administration could also provide a rare disease hotline where families could call to ask questions to see if their rare disease is listed in the manual. They would also know the Social Security Administration's preferred term for the rare disease and the specific diagnosing criteria needed to qualify for benefits. I just want to thank you for this time, for allowing us to come and speak today at the hearings. I hope my comments and suggestions have been proven helpful. I'm really honored to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I have questions. I should mention that we don't have statutory authority. We're actually barred now from referring claimants to disease organizations. Apparently, this was, depending on who you believe, an intended or an unintended consequence of some amendments to the Ticket to Work legislation in 1999 that amended our statute. I personally think would like to have that authority. It gets complicated in terms of where you draw the line in terms of which nonprofit groups, and we don't have an actual proposal on the table, but I have discussed that with the Hill. So just simply so that all of you know, I have a lot that I can probably do in my administrative discretion, and we're trying to push that as far as we can, but that's actually not one of the things right now that I have the statutory authority to do. That's a very little known fact. Matter of fact, when I came in, I didn't realize that the law had changed in that regard. I think it's an unfortunate change. Let me start, if I could, with Shelley. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just ask you a few questions about your son's situation. And if there's anything you don't want to answer, then I understand completely. So, first, was he over 18 or under 18 when he applied for Social Security benefits?
He was over 18.
He was over 18. And was he enrolled in college at that point, or was he still in high school? Or
he was still in high school. He was on the hospital homebound program. He had lost.
I'm sorry, Miss. He was on
the hospital homebound program, yeah, for school. He had lost 60 pounds in a period of 1 year. He had had 2 cardiac arrests. He had had 3 bouts of heart failure, and his heart function was down to 17% ejection fraction. And the adjudicator spoke to me once. We had a very difficult time getting through to her. But I understood. I mean, it's not uncommon. Nobody knows Barth syndrome. I've grown so accustomed to this that I just spell.
Shelley, you might want to move a little bit further away from the mic.
Okay.
I know we're still fine tuning the mics here. I apologize.
Okay. So. It's not uncommon for people not to know Barth syndrome. I've just grown accustomed to spelling it. So much so that, in fact, I was speaking with Dr. Barth one time, and I spelled B-A-R-T-H syndrome. He said, I'm familiar with the spelling disorder. So that's how accustomed we are to it. But it's children frequently, I'm not surprised. So I wanted to help the adjudicator in every way I possibly could.
Which state do you live in?
Florida.
In Florida. And how mobile was your son at that point?
He was in a class 4 heart failure. He was not feeling great, but he's.
Was he walking or was he in a wheelchair?
He walks. As I said, these kids look deceptively healthy. If you look, they have always been sick. My son, one of the things that he dislikes the most is when people say, what is it like to have Barth syndrome? What is it like to have a disability? And he says, what's it like to be healthy? I don't know. That's a silly question.
Yeah.
He's always had it.
Yeah.
So he functions really well. And one of the questions that we were asked, and I wrote these questions, and they're laden with bias. So it says, how far can you walk without resting? Well, we've always tried to make our son, help our son succeed. So while it takes us about an hour and a half to go around a block where other people could go really quickly, we take one deliberate step after another with our son. So he was answering his own questions, and to him, he was doing very well because we've always made him able.
Right.
So we had to break him down, and it was hard. It was a very hard process.
Yeah. No, it's just helpful for us to, when things are going off the tracks, to try to figure out why. I think, when we first started talking about this, I think a lot of us believed that relatively few of these cases went off track. And so rather than just have an argument, we do what I like to do, and we actually went out and collected some data and just picked 6 or 7 diseases where we all agreed that people pretty much should be entitled to benefits with that disease or condition. And the percentage that went off the track, in the majority of cases, we did the right thing, and we did the right thing fairly promptly. But on the other hand, the percentage of cases that fell off the tracks for one reason or another were higher than I think most of us thought that they were at the time. So it's important for us to try to figure out why that is. And mostly it's a failure of information. And again, it's the job of the central headquarters to try to provide that information out to the field, because I think most of the people in the field are trying hard, but they've got big caseloads, and it's just, particularly you get into the rare disease area, they just don't have a lot to rely on. And the general docs too, they often don't know that much, and they go to the textbooks and there's not much there, and that's when mistakes get made, is when there's a shortage of information. So okay, that's very helpful. Wanted to ask about Marfan, which I'm less familiar than a lot of the diseases that we've heard from today. Could you give me a little bit more of a sense of, you probably have the curse in that it's a blessing and a curse that there are some famous people that are associated or arguably associated with Marfan, and that may give people the wrong impression. Can you give me a little bit more sense of the range of the disease and the scope and the range and severity? How many people, for instance, once they become adults, roughly just are totally incapacitated? How many people are, you know, they may be struggling but are actually working? And if there are some very moderate cases, can you just, if you could fill that in for me a little bit more, that would be helpful for me.
For Marfan syndrome, there's a great variability within the syndrome. Most people, I would say, carry on full productive lives, but there is a small percentage. I don't know the statistic on this, but I would say maybe between 5 to 10% of the population that ends up being more disabled because of the chronic orthopedic issues that are happening to this older generation. There's also a set of people that have more volatile aortic problems, that have a history of dissections in their family, that have to undergo multiple surgeries. And after having multiple surgeries, one for the aortic root, one for descending aortic aneurysms, which are even, the surgery is much more risky, they end up having chronic fatigue. And they have, also with Marfan syndrome, they have what's called dural lactasia, and that starts giving them pain in their back, shooting pains down their legs, so that they have chronic pain. It doesn't happen to a high percentage. It happens to maybe 10% of the population.
Okay, that's helpful. Amy, I wanted to ask you just a little bit. I know a lot of the lysosomal storage diseases, I mean, the severe cases and the majority of cases are ones where there's no protein being expressed by the cells at all, but there's often sort of an outlier population, 5 to 10%, where there's some residual ability to produce protein, but it's limited. Is that the same way it is in Batten's?
It's exactly the same.
And what is the 5 to 10% who are least severely affected? Maybe if you could sketch out can you make any generalizations about typically what their lives look like?
For many of them, it may just be a delay of the onset of symptoms. So their body's producing enough of the protein where their seizure activity might not quite be as severe as somebody that is making less of the protein. But generally the symptoms are, I mean, there's not like a symptom isn't ever going to show up. It will definitely show up. It's very rare that it's happening to somebody. I mean, you definitely know that there's something wrong. It's not like they're going on throughout life and they're you're not seeing anything is wrong with them.
Do you know anything? I mean, do you have a gut? I mean, if you have a study, that's great. But
that's okay.
But do you have a gut sense for what life expectancy is for
it's
people
still
in that
very
part?
Low. It's still. I mean, they're still going to pass away, unfortunately, but...
Are you talking teens or 20s and 30s?
If they're lucky, 20s or early 30s. I mean, yeah. And that is very, very... If their body has to be producing an unusual amount of the protein, but very rarely are they out of their... Early 30s is long, and that's for just the juvenile onset. But if it's infantile or late infantile, it could be late teens, mid-teens, early 20s, somewhere in there, but very few past 30, late early 30s.
Okay. I've got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yesterday we heard from Ron Bartek from the Friedrich Ataxia Group, and he talked about how he took a rating scale from multiple sclerosis, I think it was, and then adapted it to them. And two of you have been successful, I guess, in getting the determination made, or your organization having the determination of disability made. Do you put up a template, or how do you make the information available to your members that this is a good way to go to work with the Social Security Administration? Do you do anything like this, or provide advice or guidance?
They hired me. That's how they did it. Yeah.
That's a good move, yeah.
I mean, before I was hired, it was the executive director doing all of this, and it was just a lot. And he doesn't, I mean, he had only had the experience himself from being a father of a child with Batten disease and being executive director for as long as he had. But he was really, I mean, it's just really trial and error for us and learning what families can do that's helped and what families aren't doing. And so we kind of, after a long amount of time, we just kind of came up with, you know, it helps a lot more if you individually list out your symptoms of your child with Batten disease instead of putting Batten disease, because they're not going to know what that is. If you put blindness, if you put loss of speech, seizure disorder, all that good stuff, they're going to be more likely to say, wow, this person really does have a major disability, and instead of just putting the one word title of Batten disease. So it was very much trial and error coming about, so.
Anyone, Shelley or Josephine?
We actually, our children, we were just established in 2000, so we're just now beginning to see these young men come around into their second decade of life. The other thing that I think is important to note is that we are primarily a virtual group, and so we have high-functioning families that are in our midst. Most of them have access to a computer, they have one in their home, they plan for their children to go to college. These are not people that would necessarily even think to ask for Social Security for their children. It was interesting, I did a survey before I left, and 67% of the families polled had never even considered asking for assistance, even though one of the parents had to quit work, the child was frequently in the hospital, they've had to claim bankruptcy. You know, it's absolutely amazing that they don't even think about. They think there's other people out there that are more needy than I am. So obviously this is something we as a group have to internally address as well. So.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I think one of the problems and one of the concerns we have dealing with the rare disease is that we know we have access to those who have ready access to the internet, but there's a significant part of the population that just does not have ready access to it. And you know, we just have difficulty reaching the entire population here in the United States. So. We're suffering the same problems too. Another question, if I can, you know, we're looking at maybe 6,000-7,000 different disorders, and we certainly can't attack. When I say we, working with the Social Security Administration, any suggestions on how you pick 300, 500 diseases, 100 diseases? Any thoughts at all? I'm sure the Social Security Administration has thought about this, but. As a patient group, I mean, I think everyone wants to be classified and be on the list. And Diane Dorman yesterday talked about low-hanging fruit, although I don't think she used that term, but something like that we could pick off various diseases that are very, very, you know, serious, and disability is quite assured. But any thoughts or any other way? How do you create a list?
I was thinking about this earlier because I was listening as I was listening. You know, this is, you guys are sitting in the hot seat. I thought I was sitting in the hot seat, but we're up here saying, you know what would be great? Here, we'll just make a list of the diseases. But you're wrong. I mean, this is, coming up with a mutation doesn't necessarily mean that it's a disease-causing mutation or that it's going to be a disease-causing mutation. And I was sitting back there, you know, I just happened to be one of the lucky ones that fell off the track, you know, but at least I'm able to get up and say this is what's happened and then consider the other side of it as to what we could do. But while you can't talk to disease groups, we can help provide, look at the symptoms, and there's got to be some common symptoms of rare diseases, and I've talked to Ron Bartek today, and then there's Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and a number of these diseases have common issues such as cardiomyopathies. And so coming up with, you know, when is it debilitating? What does it look like? What can we help to do in terms of better describing the cluster of diseases? And the other thing that was really interesting on the website is I didn't see anything about mitochondrial diseases listed on the disabilities on the website, which are pretty debilitating disorders. So that was the a suggestion that I could think of. But I would be willing to do whatever I could to help you.
When we adjudicate cases, there's always a gray area. This is a problem we have. There's very few people present themselves that are clearly not disabled, but a few do, and many that are clearly disabled, and then you get that center area. For each one of the three of you, are there beginning to be evolved objective standards or scales or measures that the physicians use, that the researchers use, to begin to identify the degree of severity of the condition? Shelley, could you start?
We just established a medical database and biorepository to develop longitudinal data. And we enlisted a university that has a biostatistician that can help rule out the bias there. It's very subjective, and we're hoping that we'll be able to come up with better standards by collecting longitudinal data. I think this is a good question. I think it's one of those future things that we need to do, but it's a struggle.
For Marfan syndrome, we do not have anything really like that. There's a lack of medical evidence showing the functional disabilities for patients with Marfan syndrome. A paper came out recently within the last 2 years beginning to look at that, at the pain associated with the disease, mainly looking at orthopedic issues, and because this is it's becoming a new entity. It's becoming more apparent in this group because they're older. Usually patients with Marfan syndrome died at a young age. We didn't have an older population. And so now we're getting into a new set of debilitating issues. They're chronic issues, their pain and their fatigue, and it's very hard to actually put a number on that. So we're beginning to have scientists look at that, but there's really nothing that is in, you know, medical evidence for that at this time.
As far as Batten disease, I mean, we know the general progression of the disease, so we know what each stage is going to kind of entail, but our children are so different as to who kind of hits what stage and when they hit it, and not all children will hit the same stages, so it's very hard to get a real clear-cut, cookie-cutter kind of picture. And it's very subjective as to what you would say is severe versus not, you know, functional versus very severe. I would say that a feeding tube would obviously be very severe, but at the same point, a child that is having mobility problems and blindness with, you know, multiple seizure activity every day would also be severe. So, unfortunately, I don't think we have really that very clear-cut data. It's still very subjective, so.
Thank you.
I have several questions. Again, Ms. Bone, if you don't want to answer this question, that's fine, but did I understand, was your son ever approved?
No, he wasn't. In fact, I consider myself as one of those people that didn't really know what to do next. The last statement on the denial said that if your condition worsens, you can always reapply. So at that point, he was in heart failure. He had lost 60 pounds. He was pretty bad. You know, there was nowhere but down to go. I let it go, and my sister-in-law, who is a social worker, chastised me for not. She said, "Well, you don't know the system," and I said, "I shouldn't have to know the system. I mean, it shouldn't be a system. I think it's tough. You know, it was really hard for me." I'm extremely optimistic and altruistic, so I believe in the greater good of the government and the world. Everybody's good and glorious, and, you know, so I just thought, well, they must have thought that, you know, he didn't need it.
Did you go to a hearing?
I reapplied, and we'll see what happens. That was a year and a half ago, but he has nothing right now, and I tried to get it on the fast track. We'll see what happens. That was 2 weeks ago.
Did you go to a hearing the first time?
I never had a hearing.
There were some comments about the Terry process, and certainly, as you suggest, we do have the process where if someone does have an illness that they are dying, certainly, or if there's some other situation that's really very dire, they're in foreclosure and so on, we do have a process where we will try to give priority, certainly, to those cases. And I think the suggestion was is that we need to be advertising that more? Is that what you're suggesting? I mean, I guess, you know, there's a little bit of an assumption that if someone's condition gets to that level or if they're in foreclosure, that they are letting us know. But I think you're suggesting, in fact, people are it's happening to people and they're not letting us know. We never become aware, in fact, that their condition is like that.
Well, with our families, with, I mean, as I kind of, just when families go in and they start listing, as we've taught them to list every single symptom and condition of their disease, a lot of times terminal illness doesn't come to mind. Or parents just, they don't know. They don't know that because their child has a terminal illness, they get a speedy process. And I don't think they're getting asked, is this a terminal illness during their process? Because from the parents that I've experienced in my unfortunately short time there, I've never heard of a family using the Terry process when applying for Social Security. And I didn't even know about it until I read the witness questions. So, and I've been doing this since June. So this is new to me as well. And now that I know, I'm obviously going to advocate for my families to, that's the first thing they're going to ask for. And I called my local Social Security office just trying to prod a little bit and see what I could get out of them. And, you know, I asked, is it a separate form? Because I didn't even know. Is it a separate form from the regular Social, let's say they're applying for SSI. Is it a separate form? And, you know, the first office I called, they didn't really want to tell me too much, and they just kind of said, well, you come in and we'll just take care of it. And then the second office I called was much more, they were much more giving me more answers, and they, you know, we'll do it, you know, we sit down with them. They just gave me a lot better answer, but I mean, it sounds to me like, and the way that I feel about it is that I don't think that the rare disease community knows that this program is out there, because I know my families aren't using it, so.
Okay. The last question, if I understood you correctly, there are a number of medical sources that are not aware of the three conditions, certainly, that all three of you have talked about here today. Are we having situations where they are reporting essentially symptoms and so on, but they're never making a diagnosis of Marfan or Barth and so on? Is that happening where no diagnosis is made? They know there's something going on, but they don't know what the actual disease is or what the impairment is. Is that what you're suggesting?
For Marfan syndrome, there's a definite diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to Marfan syndrome, what the problem is that they don't understand how it can be functionally disabling. And I think that's where the question is for Marfan syndrome.
How about the other two? Because it sounded like what you were getting at is that, in fact, these are obviously in one, I think you said 400 cases in the whole country, and the other perhaps not very many. There may be situations where, in fact, people have an illness that is leading to death or clearly disabling. They have all the symptoms, but they're not able to make the diagnosis. I'm trying to figure out what we should be, any recommendations you may have in terms of what we should be doing with that situation. I mean, how do we deal with that situation?
I can give you the statistics for diagnosis for Barth syndrome. It takes an average of 3 to 5 years to diagnose it, even today. Typically, it's first classified as not Duchenne's because you have these kids that are weak and they look like Duchenne's children. But it's a very tough disease to diagnose because, as I said, these kids are they're articulate, they're cute, they look deceptively healthy, and then they just get very sick and go downhill. So typically what happens, and there's also a high incidence of of de novo mutations in the mothers either being carriers or the boys occurring. So you won't see a family history. So oftentimes it'll be the death of one son and then another son being born and developing those symptoms before you'll see the disorder. And it is extraordinarily difficult to take care of early in life. The children have a lot of feeding problems, so it's not uncommon for a child to die within the first couple of years, and a parent would never even know what's going on.
Similarly with Batten disease, the average process, I mean, it can take 3-5. Some children still don't know, and they've had the disorder for 10 years because it is so rare that the first sign is usually vision loss. So they go to an ophthalmologist or an optometrist, and they have retinitis pigmentosa or some other ophthalmological, that's a word, disease. And then they have seizures. Then they start having seizures. Well, you're just unfortunate. You have a kid that has epilepsy and blindness. And it takes a long time before finally people start picking up on the fact that there's something else wrong with these children. And because there's so many different forms, while a child that starts with these symptoms at age 10 looks like they have a juvenile presentation and you test them for juvenile with DNA, because that's really, I mean, it's a confirming diagnosis, they don't have juvenile. So then you're back to square one with searching as to which type of Batten disease that they actually have. So we have a lot of families out there still that don't have diagnoses, but it is clearly Batten disease, as the brain atrophy, the inclusion bodies on their skin biopsies and things like that. All the other signs are pointing to Batten disease. We just don't have a clear-cut DNA confirmation diagnosis, but all the other things that point to it.
Of course, some misdiagnosis. Do we have many cases where there's, in fact, no diagnosis made?
Ever?
Or are they just simply misdiagnosing?
I'm not sure. I can't answer you that. I know we have families out there where we're still trying to find a diagnosis, and a lot of times if it looks like Batten disease, but it might not be, so we might say that it isn't. It can be very confusing. It can paint a different picture, and it might be something else and look like one thing. So I'm sure there is, but I unfortunately am not really positive on that.
I don't think we would know either. I think they would contact us because they either suspect there's a diagnosis or they've been diagnosed with it. And our sense is that the doctor sees that there's so many, the entire gene and intron and exon are not sequenced, so it could easily be that there's something going on in the mRNA or something going on with the protein product. So if the kid has the symptoms, he has Barth syndrome. So that's what we go with.
Frank actually asked, that's a really interesting question that I hadn't really even thought terribly hard about before now, because it's, whenever you have a system as big, as complicated as ours, you can't help but think in the categories of the system. I mean, it just becomes ingrained. And I think it is actually much more common, certainly, than a lot of people in the system appreciate, to have people with extremely serious problems where they never do have a diagnosis. I've got a very close friend who's got two children with the same syndrome, and they've been out to NIH a million times. They've been at every major medical center, and they can't get a diagnosis, except it's sort of like autism in certain ways, but it's clearly not autism. And they've been looking for a long time. And I suppose that's one of the things that we probably ought to take a look at, because, you know, if you can't put a label on a disease, you shouldn't really be at a disadvantage in the process. And I've never even asked the question whether, you know, when someone comes in and they don't even have a clear diagnosis, sort of how the system handles. I mean, theoretically, I think the way it's supposed to work, they shouldn't be at a disadvantage as they go through, but there may be some unintended common misconceptions and things like that. So that's probably actually something we should take a look at and just make sure that, you know, there's nothing that we can't do. And I think that's a very, very good thought. You have a couple more?
If I could just make a comment. During the life of this National Commission on Orphan Disease that I mentioned yesterday, we did a small survey of patients with known diagnosis of rare diseases. And at that point, approximately 15% of the patients, it took longer than 5 years to get a diagnosis. So that meant a lot of doctor visits, a lot of multiple hospitals, and moving up and down within the system. And even then, I think we had 31%. It took between 1 and 5 years to get the diagnosis. So you have a lot of patients visiting many, many physicians. And NORD did a similar survey in the early 2000s here, and I think they repeated those numbers. So it is a major problem, getting the diagnosis, and certainly undiagnosed diseases, or diseases of unknown origin, whatever you want to call them, it is a significant problem for the patients and for the physicians. I mean, everyone's very frustrated because you just don't know what to put on. And I think regardless of the disease, if the patients and the families just have a name, they feel at least they can start to look for information. Maybe they can find a physician who has that knowledge. So it's a tremendous task sometimes to get that diagnosis.
Steve, it's also, don't you also think that we're in an age where we're more refined? So no longer is it just heart failure. It's heart failure because of 141 possible causes, and that could be a genetic cause, or there's an inborn error metabolism that may happen, or it is
you know, heart failure is heart failure, but it is important to know what it is, and that maybe that we're not doing such a bad job, we're actually doing a better job if we're suffering because of it.
Yeah, I think the awareness of rare diseases has increased tremendously, at least the last 25 years that I'm aware of, and it's still growing, so it's good to see, but yet every time you feel you have a success, you have five other diseases that you just don't know anything about, so it keeps us young.
Steve, I have a sort of an off-the-wall question that I just want to ask you. Although if any of you know the answer,
yeah, they may know. All of a sudden,
it's hitting me. I mean, you know, it is. I mean, we all have human limitations. It's unreasonable to expect, you know, most physicians to have a handle on all the symptoms of all 7,000 rare diseases. Is there any kind of computer program using artificial intelligence techniques where if a doctor's having trouble diagnosing a patient, he can plug in the symptoms, and then there's at least a list of what the possible diagnoses could be?
There have been several, I think, systems that have been tried, but none of them have been found to be optimal. It's just there are so many confounding symptoms that come into the picture, laboratory tests, imaging results, and all of a sudden you think, well, it could be this or that, and you just don't have that differential diagnosis that pops out at you many times. Yeah. Something we really would like to see. And I think perhaps over time, as we start to do some more of the genome-wide association studies where we start looking at the genotype-phenotype correlations, we're going to be able to get some more of the natural history and that those correlations that will make some sense, and then we can draw conclusions easier. But that's still several years out. But it's starting.
Ms. Bowen, you mentioned that many of the parents never apply for benefits.
Right. 67%.
67%. Right. Never do. You also made another comment, sort of a side comment that really intrigued me, and that is part of it is it's because they don't see their children as being disabled, or they haven't thought of their children as being disabled.
Right. They, I think there is, again, these children look. They look good. They look good. And I can remember taking my son into the emergency room, being in heart failure, and the next day we were essentially told that he was going to die, and being told there's nothing wrong with him. You know, I was just overreacting. It's very deceptive. They look fine. And then this is all they know. This is all these families know. And so they're high functioning, they have computers in their home, one of the parents are able to stay home with them, they're able to ask questions, they are, these are the people who come to us, these are the ones that we know about, but the ones that I'm, you know, and they're struggling, but they're on the juxtaposition of the families that are really in need that you typically think of with Social Security and disability. You think of these indigent children and kids that are at need that don't have insurance, and you don't think, well, just because I've got to claim bankruptcy and my wife's got to quit or we've got to sell our house, at least we can sell our house. I mean, this is what I'm up against with these families. They've never even thought about it. They think that you've got to be 65 years old. That was the other misperception, is, you know, if I thought it was for only people for 65 years old or older. So.
Is this a problem that the other two hear, Amy, and do you hear the same sorts of comments about the applying for benefits?
They get very frustrated because they know they make too much money, and so they don't even. I mean, I think a lot of our families just know that they make too much money, so they're not going to apply. But I also think then that they don't. They kind of leave it at that, and they forget about the Social Security Administration. And I think a lot of them even forget after their child turns 18 that their child can go and apply for Social Security disability benefits. So I think, and we have a lot of families too, where it's upper middle class or middle class, and they just make too much money. And so they leave it at that too. They don't go back and try and reapply when their financial situation changes. So yeah, I agree with her completely. We've experienced a lot of that, the same things too.
I think for the Marfan population, it's not really like that, because usually they are more adults that are applying for disability. They were working and they were, you know, having a steady job, but then just as their symptoms get more severe and they find that they can't hold down a job anymore, then they look to see what else that they can do to get insurance. and to get, you know, other coverage.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to thank the panelists very much. This was very helpful. We're going to move now into taking comment from the public. This is probably an opportune time for me to thank Diane Dorman and the National Organization of Rare Disorders for getting the word out of this. And I know we've had a lot of interest in some people that want to speak today. And I think we've probably promised the first couple slots up to some, a couple specific disease associations, but be patient if you're waiting out there. We'll get to everybody. So I think if I remember correctly, we've got representatives from Tourette syndrome here that would like to speak.
Thank you, Commissioner Astor, and fellow affiliate members for the opportunity to present our view concerning the eligibility screening process for compassionate allowance for Tourette syndrome. My name is Nancy Thomas Baker, and I'm here on behalf of the Tourette Syndrome Association and its members. I have a 12-year-old daughter with Tourette syndrome. As you may know, the TSA is the only national voluntary nonprofit membership organization dedicated to identifying the cause, finding the cure, and improving the quality of life for individuals with TS. Tourette syndrome is an inherited neurological disorder characterized by involuntary movements and sounds that are known as tics. The disorder is often accompanied by attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and/or obsessive compulsive disorder. There is no known cure for TS. We commend SSA's initiative to provide a quick and deliberate process for determining eligibility for public services by SSA. However, we strongly urge the consideration of additional provisions that would recognize and cover serious disabilities incurred by patients with severe TS. TS is a neurological disorder causing significant health impairments among the more severely affected. In our view, clearly this condition should be recognized officially as a disability under compassionate allowance. Under current circumstances, we believe that people with TS do not receive a timely or deliberative eligibility decision due to a lack of understanding of the disorder and its effects on some individuals. The TSA has informally surveyed key physicians who are responsible for TS clinics and stakeholders in several regions of the country. This survey indicates that even for those who eventually did receive approval for SSA benefits and services, the process was unacceptably lengthy, with patients having to pursue an endless appeals process. For those with disabling TS motor tics, as well as inappropriate prominent vocal symptoms, the quality of life can only be described as non-existent and often intolerable. Some of the most disabling factors that make it nearly impossible to cope with TS symptoms include self-mutilating behaviors, social isolation, and employment discrimination due to public stigmatization. These very troubling symptoms are just a few examples of the most disabling outcomes that result from having this complex disorder. Therefore, we recommend that a comprehensive document be developed that would provide specific guidelines for determination of patient eligibility. Furthermore, we suggest that SSA determine disability based on a case-by-case basis. These would include, but would not be limited to, diagnosis, symptom severity, and impairment, as well as quality of life impact. Because unfortunately, we do not fall under most of SSA's expedited processes of claims, we cannot answer some of the specific questions about how these processes are working for individuals with TS. However, we would like to reiterate that increased SSA understanding about Tourette syndrome with inclusion of accurate medical information will result in fewer unwarranted denials and appeals. This improved knowledge will improve critical support for people with TS. The TSA sponsors a multidisciplinary national medical advisory board whose members are available to guide and advise the SSA on all matters regarding TS patients. We urge the SSA to take advantage of the expertise of the Tourette Syndrome Association's medical advisory board by consulting on the objective medically evidentiary requirements for TS eligibility. As a mother of a 12-year-old with Tourette syndrome and a board member of the National Tourette Syndrome Association, I would like to request that the SSA consider TSA's views and make every effort to serve our most vulnerable citizens with Tourette syndrome. We recommend that SSA expand the list of impairments to include Tourette syndrome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I should mention that we have, we're in the process of doing overhauls of a number of our body systems for the listings. We've got 14 areas in our current regulations. Neurology is not next in the line, but it's right up there near the top of the queue. And so it is, your comments are very timely because we'll be revising our rules in the neurology area generally over the coming months. And so getting any sort of detailed comment in on what you'd like to see should be very helpful. And in particular, as I said at the outset, we have our ordinary procedures and listings, and we don't want to overlook that. We want to make sure that those are right, too. To the extent that there are going to be extremely severe cases that might qualify for one of our expedited review systems, to the extent that you can give us help on how to sort out the most severe patients from the less severe patients, that's extremely useful information to us as well.
Very good. There's also a video that HBO, a documentary that they did on Tourette syndrome, and in that we can provide you with a copy of that, and also the medical advisory board. It's very clear, you know, the severe cases. My child's is moderate to severe, and over time it's improving. But the severe cases, it's obvious just to the eye. I mean, the tics are so pronounced.
I don't mean to be difficult, but one of the things you have to put yourself in my shoes for a moment. We've got thousands of people that work for state agencies around the country that make these decisions for us. And we really, I mean, again, no disrespect to them. I think, you know, they're hardworking, wonderful people almost to a person. But it's unreasonable to expect that they're well-educated on every disease and condition. And what we have to do, what our job is in Baltimore, is we've got to break it down as simply and clearly as possible. And I know it's got to be frustrating for patient advocates because it's so obvious to all of you, and it may even be obvious to us up here. But what we've got to do, our job, is we've got to find a way to make it obvious to people that don't know anything about Tourette syndrome or Batten disease or something like else. So to the extent that you can help us put it into words so we can tell people out in the states and we can tell our administrative law judges how they ought to be looking at it. Anything you can do
Absolutely.
In that regard is very helpful to us.
Thank you.
Anybody else? No? Okay, Diana, I got such an overload of information. I know I promised the next slot, but now I've forgotten. Oh, yes, yeah.
Brianna,
yes.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Rosalie Lewis from the Dystonia Medical Research Foundation. And along with all the other advocates who have spoken today, as I would like to thank you for the opportunity for all of us. But I have to say, I have been so educated by the advocates today who have presented. It's been a marvelous time. In any case, I have been involved with the Dystonia Medical Research Foundation for the last 30 years when the first of my four sons were diagnosed with this neurological movement disease, three of whom have the disease actively and the fourth is an asymptomatic carrier of the disease. I represent the foundation as an immediate past president and as the current vice president of public policy and also as the chair of the Dystonia Advocacy Coalition, which represents five other dystonia groups within the United States. The Dystonia Foundation was founded, just like many other advocacy groups, with the intent to raise awareness and educate the medical and lay community, to do support services for our community, as well as to fund medical research. And we have been very successful in uncovering a lot of new science. But in the process, as you can well imagine, that leads to the next question. More and more of the sciences is not understood. And in fact, when I speak about dystonia, people look at me and say, is that a country in Eastern Europe? So we do have a lot of work to do every single day of our lives. So what is dystonia? Well, unlike several of the diseases that you've heard of already, dystonia represents about 300,000 people, and that's a conservative estimate, in the United States alone. There are so many different forms of dystonia that in the composite, we say there can be as much as 500,000. However, the focal dystonias represent smaller populations, and I'll get into the different forms just to give a little explanation about why it's so difficult for the Social Security Administration and others to say, oh, this is dystonia and this is a severe illness. So dystonia is a neurological movement disorder that affects the muscles of the body, causing contractures, spasms, pain, chronic issues, and it's progressive. So there is a form of generalized dystonia that my children have. It's a genetic autosomal dominant form that starts around the age of 7. A child is born looking perfectly normal. When it gets to a developmental stage in their lives, all of a sudden they can't walk. They can't use their hand. Their voice might be affected, as well as possibly, but not very likely, torticollis will set in where their head is pulled to a side or the back. From that point, age 7 on, through their adult years, the disease progresses. There is no cure for dystonia. There are medications, but the medication side effects oftentimes makes the disease almost worse than it is. The focal dystonias start more in a person's 40s to 50s, just when they're the most productive in their careers. It can be so disabling that a person who develops blepharospasm, which is excessive blinking of the eyelids, they become functionally blind. They can't see well enough to walk down the street by themselves, cross the street, read a book, certainly not to drive. People who have oromandibular dystonia have it so that their jaw is clenched shut. They cannot speak, nor can they eat. Spasmodic dysphonia is the focal dystonia of the vocal cords, where production of sound becomes constrained, so it sounds like this, or it's very, very whispery. One of my sons developed that in addition to his generalized dystonia and needed botulinum toxin injections into his vocal cords, which were not very helpful. Focal dystonia of the arm prevents the person from writing. Their hands become contracted like this. So if they're trying to hold a job and they're trying to use a computer, they can no longer do that. It's involuntary contractions, usually as a result of trying to do a job. When a person with dystonia sleeps, the muscles are relaxed and everything is calm. As soon as they're up, the spasm starts all over again. Another form of focal dystonia, and you've heard this in musicians. Musicians have developed dystonia, and that makes them totally unable to continue their career, whether it be in the muscles around their lips, so they no longer can play a wind instrument, or they no longer can finger a guitar or any other stringed instrument, or conductor of orchestras no longer can use the baton and keep it going. Focal dystonia also has affected Leon Fleischer. Many of you have heard him, the pianist. He can no longer play the piano until recently when the Botox shot started to work. In fact, he just won an award at the Kennedy Center the other night for his striving to perform. So there are many genetic forms of dystonia, and then there are forms of dystonia that come as a result secondary to injury, traumatic brain injury, a limb injury, or an injury or a subsequent to disease, medications for diseases not related to dystonia but cause dystonia. There are people with Parkinson's disease who have dystonia, as well as people who start with dystonia that develop Parkinsonian-like symptoms. So you can see the range of the disease. It can be not terribly severe to so severe that a person is twisted up into a pretzel, and that's one of the descriptive terms, pretzel-like. And if you saw a person, specifically a young child, with severe dystonia, they can't dress themselves, eat, certainly cannot walk. It's really most scary. I heard you ask some other people about a rating scale. Yes, in dystonia, we do have rating scales. It is a very subjective scale, as you can well imagine. My son, who was going and did have deep brain stimulation surgery to correct the symptoms of generalized dystonia, had the rating scale performed before and post-surgery, and the results were all remarkable. It was a tremendous success for him, thank goodness. Other people, though, have the rating scale done in order to qualify for benefits within their health insurance, but it might be very helpful within the Social Security application process. I had my notes, but to tell you the truth, I guess the easiest thing is just to tell you from my heart. As I've been involved with the foundation for 30 years since my children were diagnosed, I have seen adults with their focal dystonias have their lives destroyed. When it hits almost overnight. Nobody understands what's going on. They go to their doctor, they say, oh, it's a psychological issue, stop drinking or drink. Nobody initially knows what to do, but when you see a patient, a friend, walk with their head stuck to their shoulder because they can't pull the muscle straight back, focusing this way, you can't walk. You'll bump into everything. Or a person whose eyes are shut tight. They no longer can even take care of their children. It's a terribly disabling, severe disease that I appreciate the difficulty from your end to look at a person that says coded dystonia without fully understanding the full scope of the disease. And I appreciate what you just said to the woman from the Tourette's Association. And the Dystonia Medical Research Foundation will be happy to supply you with information that might be of benefit as you look through the neurological diseases. We also have a very fine medical advisory group worldwide who can help in any responses to scientific questions, clinical diagnosis questions. We have a dystonia study group who are trying new medications and therapies. We're seasoned, and yet we're very new. I really thank you for the opportunity to discuss this, because there are 30,000 people just within the foundation who are really eager to have your help.
Thank you very much. Certainly the scale would be helpful to us. Any studies associated with the development of the scale or the validation of the scale are very important. And if you've got a couple top-notch docs who, you know, would be willing to talk to us about this is obviously one of the ones that's very complex from our point of view to try to get a handle on, but you know, forwarding to us some doctors that we could ask questions to once we look at this again, I think that would be very helpful to us as well. So that I thank you. Gentlemen, anything else? Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to ask the last two witnesses if you could just comment very, very briefly on, for the individuals who have the conditions that you've described, what's been the experience in dealing with our process? Are people who are applying with these conditions, are they being approved pretty quickly, or is it not happening that way?
So I asked via the survey on my website, and it's anyways from 6 months to 2 years. Children get approved much more quickly. Adults don't. And sometimes, I think it's about 80% do get approved finally if they go before the judge. If they don't, it gets rejected.
Thank you.
We are not sure overall. It varies case to case how long it takes to get approved. And because we're getting the information not from the patients themselves, but from medical professionals who are dealing with the patients. So the TSA is now gathering information on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
My staff has made a very important request, which they've asked me to define the word us when I say get in touch with us. So you will find that although I have all the best of intentions, I get such a huge volume of mail that sending it to me directly, while that may seem logical, isn't probably in your best interest. So we do have in the materials the email address for comments, and that genuinely, for everything that we're discussing today, genuinely is the best place to do it. And if I remember correctly, I'm doing this from memory, Diane, but it's compassionate.allowances@ssa.gov. I got that right. Okay, so it's compassionate.allowances@ssa.gov, and that really is the best place to direct any comments that you have. So those are the two that I knew were here, but there may be others here. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to add to what we've heard already today? Going once, going up, yep, okay.
Hi, I'd like to thank you. My name's John Yukin. I have a child with juvenile Batten disease, 10 years old. I was blessed because we got a diagnosis within 18 months. Most of these kids don't get, with juvenile Batten disease, don't get diagnosed till the ages of 15, 16 when seizures begin. And it's just such a frustrating feeling because every social worker we've talked to says, you qualify. But every time we come back, it's income. And it's not even an answer where to go from here. It's just, okay, you don't qualify, thank you very much. And it's just such a frustrating feeling because you hear it from all the workers saying, you meet everything, but you don't. And we've even started looking at the autistic waiver. We've got a social worker that's looking at that because a lot of the children with Batten disease have a lot of the autistic symptoms, but some people don't want to fill out the paperwork because it doesn't relate to Batten disease. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else?
I have a question.
Yeah.
For you. You get to ask us questions.
Hey, wait a minute. I make the rules here. Forget that. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Ask whatever you want.
You know, you're in Washington, D.C., and you guys get a lot of information, and yeah. I just want to commend you for being so receptive. And I just did an organizational evaluation for the few children that I take care of, and it was just a cacophony of noise. I was ready to go nuts. But sometimes it's just good to just get away and put people together in a think tank about what the issues happen to be. And it occurs to me that this is not just about Social Security. This is not just about rare diseases. This is about new survivors, better medicine, new issues that are occurring. And we are in an advent of technology now where we can create health records, electronic health records that can go with us, with our children wherever we go. But somehow there's got to be a way where you guys, I'll cook dinner, you can come to Florida, we'll do a cookout, you can just chill and fish and talk. But just, does that ever happen? You know, besides watching C-SPAN and then when it pans out and there's nobody in the audience, that's my extent of you know, being able to really see discussions happening here. What happens?
Yeah, well, it's real hard. You know, we, particularly when you get in an organization as large as this, it's very hard to deal with things except through hierarchy and process and things like that. And we need a lot of that to do our job. We would break down and not be able to function. You can't manage 60,000 people in a highly fluid way. But if I understand what you're saying properly, I think I agree completely, and it should at least be reassuring that I think it does happen. So when I recuperate from these 2 days, I start off tomorrow, and what we've actually taken most of the senior staff off-site to develop a new strategic plan for the agency, because we have a lot of challenges. We have, because of demographics, our workloads are going up. Because of new congressional mandates, our workloads are going up. And we've been below the president's budget for 12 consecutive years. And the only way out of that box is to think about dramatically new ways of doing our business through technology, through different procedures, through involving other entities in different ways than what we've done before. So, in fact, a lot of the senior staff is going off-site tomorrow as the kickoff for a new strategic plan for the agency. We've also been trying to do this, and I think this has gone pretty well so far. We're not there yet. The woman sitting directly behind you is co-chair of a group that's working with the 50 states and four other jurisdictions that run the disability determination systems for us to work on something that may seem arcane compared to what we've been talking about today for most of you, but is critically important to what we do and how we do it, which is to see if we can come up with a unified IT system. Right now, the states have COBOL-based, you know, which is, you know, state-of-the-art 1970 code, and it's making it increasingly difficult for us to adapt and plug in new technologies. And each of the states has a different system. There's some commonalities. There's several contractors that did the spines for a number, but they're basically we're running 54 different IT systems. And that makes it harder to adapt to change. That makes it harder to tell from my position, or probably more important, Dave Rust, who's really in the hot seat on this, and Linda McMahon in operations, for us to tell what's really working and what's not, because we think we see patterns, you know, where one state is falling short of another, and the response invariably and understandably as well, you know, it's apples and oranges because Florida's measuring it differently from Virginia or vice versa. And what we've tried to do, this, we had an effort to do this once before, and it failed because it was too top-down federal. And what we're trying to do now is really try to take the whole notion of partnership seriously and get all the states involved and talk out the issues in advance and really make sure we come up with a plan that they want to do. And so we had, Ruby, what, 250 people together for 3 days, and we had a couple large kickoff sessions, and then we broke up into small groups, and then we reconfigured them, and we're still working on that. But I think that you're right. If we're, particularly when we're dealing with the bigger picture issues, we do have to pull out of our day-to-day, and we have to sort of engage with a different, sometimes a very different group of people, and think about things differently, and try to make sure that for all our very careful attention to the detail, you know, we haven't lost track of the big picture. So that's what we're doing tomorrow. That's what we did last week with the state DDSs, and that's really what we're trying to do here, not only today, but we've built in that this is not a one-shot deal. This is going to be an ongoing quarterly thing. It won't be rare diseases every time. You probably won't have another turn for a while. We've got oncology is next. I think traumatic injuries after that, and then chronic disease after that. So there may be some overlap for some of you in the chronic disease area, and then we'll have another four next year. So I think we're trying to take that to heart. You know, we may not take it to heart as much as we should in some areas, but we are trying to take that to heart. So, but that was a fair question. I'll take a question like that anytime. Anybody else? Going once, going twice. All right, again, thank you all very much. Thank you to my long-suffering staff who did such a great job putting this together, all the participants, National Organization for Rare Diseases, NIH, which has been invaluable, and anybody else that I've left out. This has been a terrific couple days, and I thank everybody.